So what I'd like to do for this Dharma talk time is to talk a little bit about the fourth aggregate, which is usually translated as mental formations, and then do a guided meditation exploration, and then talk some more. And and we're not following the order, because the next third one would have been perceptions, and but we're doing mental formations because that seems to be up for some of you. Your mental formations are probably active and alive and well, and might be easier to recognize or address at this particular juncture of the retreat. And then maybe, and tomorrow we'll do the perceptions. So there's a chant that is one of the most common chants in Theravada Buddhism. And it was, in the suttas, it was recited after the Buddha died, in kind of in marking his death, his passing. And it's sometimes used in funeral ceremonies, memorial ceremonies in Theravada Buddhism. When my son was born, it was the first thing he heard from me. It's what I chanted, this chant. And it goes something like this. Anicca vata sankara upadava yodamino Ubhagitu aneru chanti tesang vupasamo sukho. And what it's, how it translates is formations, conditioned things, constructs, are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing. In coming to be, in arising, they pass away. The calming of these is happiness. So the topic of this chant is sankharas, the word in the for the fourth aggregate that's translated as mental formations. I prefer the translation constructions, mental constructions, because there's the idea of constructions for me is a little more intentional, something we construct. Formations, like, well, something forms it, and you know, it's a little bit more distant. And we're talking about something that's very personal and very integral to who we are. And if the body is a temple, as I said earlier in the retreat, then the sankharas are the builders of the temple, the constructions, that which constructs and builds and creates. And so this chant has to do about these constructions. And it says, in a variety of ways, it says it's they're impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing. The nature of whatever arises, whatever appears, whatever is born, will pass away. So you can imagine why it's chanted at the, when someone dies, because just recognizing what is true. It's part of nature that whoever is born will one day or other will die. And there's something about, I think, very meaningful to look that truth right in the eyes and just really see it and acknowledge it. Plenty of people ignore that and don't want to really look at that truth. They might know it, but they're not going to spend much time facing it and living in the light of it. But all things. And here in the fourth aggregate, we're talking about mental constructions, meaning the constructive activity of the mind. It encompasses a lot of different things. It encompasses foremost, it includes intentions. the things that we want, things we're trying to do, our hopes and aspirations. And, but it also includes, you know, almost any mental activity that we do, you know, so memories and plans and, you know, emotions have to fit into that category. If the five aggregates, I think emotions are somewhat complex composite events that are made up of different things and they're constructed. And in calling this inner life of the mind, mental activities, constructions, is not to negate them or belittle them, or, you know, even the word aggregate, it's, you know, aggregate and constructions, like, sounds like we're in a construction site. You know, the aggregate is what you put into cement, you know. In America, usually that's mostly we talk about that for the word aggregate. And I think we're talking about something that's integral to who we are and something that warrants our respect, our care, perhaps even our reverence as we tune in to this inner life of ours. And there are some people who are very much in touch with parts of their inner mental landscape and mental activities. Some people very little of it. Some people know big parts of it, but to really not only understand parts of it, to see it, but to understand its nature, to understand how it works, and most importantly, in terms of the path of liberation, is the last line of this chant. The calming of these constructions is happiness. Bringing to peace these constructions is happiness. So the whole chant, you know, you might sound kind of depressing, you know, talking about things arising and passing, chanted at a funeral. But the whole point of this chant is to point to possibility of being happy, happiness. And how do we discover how to be happy in the face of impermanent phenomena? Things change. It's actually kind of taken to be the good news that our mental activities that we have the nature of arising and passing. They're inconstant. They are activities, they are processes, they are not fixed things. And therefore, they're malleable. And, you know, as you know, scientists are coming up now that the mind is much more malleable than the brain, is much more malleable than people had assumed. And it's more plastic, it can grow new neurons, it can create new connections much longer into, you know, the whole lifetime. So even though, you know, the brain is not a fixed thing, and so the mind, which I don't know if we should equate the brain with the mind, but the mind is even more a series of activities that work together. And if we seek the fourth aggregate of mental formations, mental constructions, as activities, then we can appreciate these activities can be going fast, can be going slow, could be going in counter purposes with each other, cannot be in harmony, can be in harmony with each other. So all this inner landscape of activities that go on. And it's possible to calm these activities down. And it's the calming of these activities that brings a certain kind of happiness, the happiness of freedom, happiness of liberation. And if the activities of our minds were fixed and they're always going at the same speed, the same intensity, without any possibility of change, then, you know, then we're just stuck with that as it is. And so one of the things that meditation is famous for is bringing calmness. People will often do meditation to de-stress and become calmer. And this is an important part of meditation, to allow the mental chatter, the mental activity, to quiet enough that we start seeing that they are in fact impermanent, arising and passing. To see into the nature of these activities. And one of the things to see is to see how we identify them, how we believe in them, to see their authority, see the attachment and clinging that's involved. If we don't slow down enough to see how it works, how all this works, it's very easy to assume or I mean that's even saying too much, unconsciously assume that what we think is what is. That what we think is true, like it's just that's how it is, you know. But if you can watch a thought be born, and you can watch a thought go away, you're in a much better position to question whether the thought is true or not, or whether you should pick it up or not, or get involved or not. But if the thought just is there, boom, you know, full blown, but you know, you don't even know it's there, and it casts a huge impression or a huge filter in how we see the world, then we don't even know it's there, but we think that's what how the world is. This is how we are. Beliefs operate this way. If we can see that a belief is just an activity of the mind, and see how that activity arises and passes, then we're less likely to be caught in the grip of the belief that we have. Because if we don't see it arise and pass, then it's just there. And if it's just there, kind of in the background without really understanding it or understanding that it's there, it's like it can very easily subconsciously have us believing that this is how it is, this is true. This is the way the universe was built. This is inherent to everything. And then we're locked in to those beliefs. But to see the arising and passing of them, to see them, to have the mind calm down, to see them clearly, is a very important stepping stone towards freedom. So with that, what I'd like to do is do a guided meditation with you, guided adventure, to explore some of the inner landscape of your fourth aggregate, the inner landscape of your mental activity, of your mental formations, constructions. Because it might be easier to understand all this if you don't just listen to what I have to say, but actually can see it or feel it, experience it in yourself. So sitting quietly and closing your eyes, taking a few long, slow, deep breaths to reconnect. As you exhale, settle back in. It's been about 30 minutes since you were in the hall meditating here, and perhaps take a few moments here in silence to reconnect. Relax. Come back into yourself and settle down. And for a few more moments here, as you exhale, see if you can let go of your thoughts, as if your thoughts are thought bubbles that float away, like soap bubbles, as you exhale. And some of you may have been letting go of a lot of thoughts in the course of this retreat, trying to keep them from being here. So for the next little while, I would like you to think. You're allowed to think anything you want, whatsoever. In fact, if you find yourself not thinking, let go of that and start thinking about something. And then as you're thinking, I'm going to ask you some questions to help you notice something about your different things about your thoughts. First, do you think more in words or more in images? If you think in words, is it with an inner voice that does the speaking, or is it more like words on a book that you see? If you think in images, are the images simple? Are they black and white or in color? And if you think in words, maybe with an inner voice that speaks them, what's the tone of the voice that speaks? What's the mood or the tone of that voice? Is it gentle or harsh? Is it forceful or hesitant? Is it kind or angry, judgmental? Is it scared or is it confident? If you think more in images, are the images, what mood, what's the atmosphere of the images? The atmosphere of danger, or the ominous, or are they pleasant, safe, comfortable images? What's the mood of them? Are there any emotions that seem to come along with your thinking? Alongside them, in them? In their wake, or as their prompt. If you think in words, in an inner voice, is there a location where the loudspeaker is or where the speaking happens? If you think in images, is there a location for the images, the stage or screen upon which they appear? Where is that location for you? What happens to you if you identify a general place where it occurs? And in connection to your thinking, as you think, is there any pressure or tension or agitation in your body? Maybe in the location where you do your thinking, is there any pressure or tension or heightened energy? Or are there any physical feelings that come with your thinking? You know that sometimes when people think a lot, they furrow their eyebrows, or there's tension in the shoulders or the jaws. Or squinting of the eyes. Anything physical connected to your thinking that you can identify. And if there is any tension or pressure, tightness connected to thinking, for the next two or three breaths as you exhale, perhaps you can relax that, smooth it out. And then what's your relationship to your thoughts? Are you glued to them? Do you believe them? Are you actively involved with them? Are you interested in what you're thinking about, or are you disinterested or neutral? You sense any kind of force that keeps you connected to your thinking, like a force of gravity or super glue. Are you believing your thoughts, or are you not particularly believing them, they just are? As you think, are there any spaces between your thoughts, or do you think non-stop with no gaps? And if there's any gaps or pauses between your thoughts, what's it like to notice those gaps if you can't use thoughts to explain it to yourself? Is your thinking the full picture of what's happening right now? All-encompassing? Or is there part of yourself, part of your experience that's outside of what you're thinking about? What's beyond the edges of your thoughts? Who are you if you don't have thoughts to answer the question? What is a thought? What is thinking? What is it if you don't use thoughts to answer the question? I'm going to make some statements about thoughts. As you hear these statements, see how they land in the world of your thinking. Thoughts have no weight. Thoughts have no substance. Thoughts are impermanent. They come and they go. Thoughts are a kind of virtual reality. And as you continue to be present for the world of your thinking, notice if you can the beginning of a thought. And notice when that particular thought is no longer there. You have the same thought that goes on and on nonstop? Or are there punctuations and pauses and new thoughts that arise? And what's it like to watch the beginning and to know the end? They come into existence and they go. Relaxing a bit, relaxing your mind, relaxing your body. And at this point, switch your attention to more be aware of desire. As desire arises, whether it's desire for something or desire for something to go away, or notice the birth of desire, the presence of desire. If you have no desires, then just sit quietly. Or it might take the form of aversion, not wanting. Or it might take the form of liking and not liking. What happens to you if you allow your awareness to to notice the simple or not so simple experience of wanting and not wanting, liking and not liking. And how is it for you to be aware of desire and liking and not liking? Do you notice if you get pulled into them or pulled around by them? Or can you notice whether you observe it as a natural phenomena that exists, that comes and goes, but it's not you, it's nothing to react to, nothing to believe. It's just a mental activity that arises and passes, arises, exists for a while and passes. What is a desire? What is to like? What is not liking? And then finally, if you like, you can return now to your breathing. Allowing the world of thoughts and liking and not liking desires to recede from, and to recede into the background. And take a few moments, if it's helpful, to rest with your breathing, just to breathe. No longer focusing so much on the inner mental landscape. And now just resting with the physical experience of breathing in and breathing out. then to end this sitting, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes if you'd like. When I do this guided meditation with a group of people, there's usually a few people who find it surprising that they've been struggling with their thoughts for days, batting them away, trying to get rid of them. Thoughts won't stop. And then finally, when they have permission to look at their thoughts and really to think, they kind of like don't think. They stop thinking. It's like, where are they? You don't have to get rid of your thoughts to do this mindfulness practice. All you need to do is just, mindfulness is to be mindful of what's happening, mindful with what's happening. And if thinking is happening, there's a beautiful art to being mindful of thinking. You don't have to, it doesn't have to go away, you don't have to get rid of it. But as we are mindful of it, it's possible to discover or explore. Let it become richer, and see the landscape of thinking, what's going on. And, you know, often we're just involved with the content of our thoughts. But to start realizing there's much more going on. Some people, when I do this, are surprised by the tone of the inner voice. They had no idea the particular emotional expression that was there as part of that tone. Occasionally, some people are surprised that it's not their voice. But it's the voice of usually some stern or harsh parent or teacher they've internalized. So who's doing the thinking if it's not your voice? And some people find that just simply noticing whether they think in words or in images gives them kind of a handle to kind of be more present, more mindful of what's really going on, and to see that it's a particular way of thinking. And also, sometimes by noticing the location of where the thinks, some people find that it's kind of like if you've been to the movies and you're a beautiful, exciting, whatever scene, and you're completely mesmerized by what's going on in the movie, like you're living in it, you know. And then the person next to you gets up and spills popcorn on your lap as they walk by you, and you kind of like wake up and you realize you're in a movie theater, and the other person on your left is slurping their Coke, and it's like you look around and you see all these people staring at the screen, and you see the light and you see these images on the screen, and you no longer see it as a real thing. You see it, oh, it's, you woke up. So the same thing can happen with our thinking. You can kind of see it, can you wake up? You don't have to stop thinking, but you can kind of wake up, oh, it's like this image, they're just happening there. It's not real, it's just an image. Just thoughts. Are thoughts so dangerous? The answer is both yes and no. They're dangerous if we believe in them, or they push us around, or we take them as solid and real. But they're not dangerous if we can see them as just, if we can wake up to them like we wake up in the movie. Oh, look at that. There can be emotions connected to thinking, there can be tension connected to it. But the most interesting thing, I think, sometimes, very subtle, it's not easy to see, but to see the way we are involved with the thinking, the way we're tied to it or bound to it. And, sometimes you feel like you can't get away from it, like you're glued to your thoughts, you are your thoughts. And other times, thoughts just float by like a cloud in the sky, and just you watch, there it goes, coming and going. How is it for you? Are you usually glued to your thoughts? Do you usually, you are your thoughts? Or are your thoughts kind of, you know, maybe you're not inclined to take your thoughts as my thoughts? Just who knows whose thoughts they are? Just they are yours, I guess. But my wife, when she had medically induced menopause for a procedure she had to do, she, during that time, those months, she would say, I'm having some strange thoughts, but these thoughts are not mine. And they weren't anybody else's, but she didn't take them as hers, like, you know, identify with it. The thoughts, they just come, they go. It's easier to see all this as the mind quiets down. It's easier to kind of see them, you know, in a relaxed, open way, just even the most painful thought you can possibly create for yourself. You know, painful in the sense, or maybe painful is not the right word, but maybe the most distasteful thought you could ever have. It's just a thought, it just goes by, and you see it, and you don't have to identify with it. It's just, or you can feel you're glued to it, or you believe it, or you give it a lot of authority. You can feel, you can see all this, it's part of the terrain of it all. And then, kind of connected to the world of thinking, or at least certainly the world of the mental formations, is our desires. And desires have many of the same qualities of thoughts. Sometimes they're more intimately tied to our physical body. You can feel this impulse to do because of your intention. But desires also have a component part where they're also, they have no weight, they have no shape and sense, they have no no substance. They arise and they pass. They have a location, maybe. And we have a relationship to them. We can be wedded to them, or we can just, thoughts can arise. I'm kind of the Buddhist personality types, I believe I'm a desire type. And for me, desires are a dime a dozen. You know, I have no trouble having desires. And so I don't mind having desires. It's okay. You know, just I just come through and I just pick and choose through them. Mostly I pick very few of them. Most of them are not worth picking. They just go through. If you're an aversive type, you probably have aversions. They're a dime a dozen, a penny a dozen. Maybe they're cheaper. And so, you know, hopefully you're careful in picking and choosing which ones you kind of get involved in. And just, oh, just, there it is again. And just aversion. Human beings have had desire and aversion for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's not like new with you. It's not going to end with you. It's just what the mind does, what the brain does. We don't have to see it as a problem. We don't have to believe it. We don't have to get involved in it. We don't have to say that because I'm having a desire, I'm having an aversion, it must be true. And so one of the mental formations that's all part of this, you can also watch, is how we identify with it. We make a sense of self out of it. I am my thoughts, or the thoughts are telling a story of who I am. Spinning its magic and creating a gill. Our desires and our aversions, we identify them. They get very personal. We think, this is who I am. It's my needs, what I want, who I have to be. Desires are often connected to thoughts and hopes and aspirations. Aversions to not being. Particular aversion that I have is, believe it or not, I don't want to be anybody. That's kind of like one of my little attachments. You know me for a long time. I don't want to wear any clothes that have logos on them. Some people like them because I don't want to be anybody to put me in a category or something, or be something. As if I can manage to do that, right? You know, no matter what you do, whatever I wear or something, it puts me somewhere, but I protect my, so a little aversion there, but am I really what I'm trying to protect myself against being? I don't care. I have this tendency, this thing goes on in my mind, and I try to be wise about it, and I sometimes smile at myself and Gail, there you are. You have to make some choices. Go to the store and see all the t-shirts. You have to make some choice. So this inner landscape, to start becoming wise about it and see it, and this teasing apart these aggregates is meant to be a way of seeing each of these in its own right. So if you see a body, the form, the sensations, just sensations, there's something very powerful about just seeing it as sensations. It's very powerful to see the feeling tones, it's just a feeling tone. You know, to go to a very difficult situation and it's very complicated, instead of getting involved in the complexity of the situation, and just say, oh, it's unpleasant. I can be with unpleasant. Just keep it simple, just unpleasant. It makes things kind of very simple if you just kind of tease it apart, just have that be there for a while. Perceptions the same way. And mental formations, to see it just as a thought, just to see it for what it is. But when we jumble all these things together, it's very hard to get a realistic view of what these things are, and we tend to believe them more strongly. And we tend to limit them, or squash them, or get involved in them, or act on them, or so it gets all kind of distorted so quickly. But if we can kind of step back and just watch and see, and maybe even just let them be, we have a chance to become wiser, and we can have a chance to let what needs to happen on the inside unfold more freely and naturally. You don't necessarily know why you're thinking what you think. Maybe what you're thinking is very important. If you give space for it and don't get involved in it, don't interfere with it, but don't feed it, just watch it, just know it, then perhaps this whatever wisdom, internal wisdom that knows, will take care of it. Will unfold in a certain kind of way. But if you're involved in trying to get rid of it and squash it and push it away and have it and change it, maybe it's disrespectful for your inner life. But if you feed it also. So the image that I kind of like for an awake life is in fact the image of the Buddha sitting and meditating. It's wonderful, upright, torso straight back, very alert and present and grounded and solid and kind of like a redwood tree, kind of just there in a strong way. To be awake, to have that stance, to have that way. And then in that place, in that state, to let the mental formations be as they are. Then we don't feed them, we don't get involved with them, we don't necessarily believe them. We're not running away from them, we're not denying them. And if we don't feed them, then what needs to happen will unfold. But if you lose that posture, and this image I have, this representation, I think I did this the other day, right? You know, so you have a lot of self-pity and you collapse like, you know, oh no, and, you know, then you're involved. And probably you're feeding something. It's not bad to do those things, but it has a different kind of effect and different consequence than just let self-pity be there and just sit up straight and just... So to let these things be and is one way to allow them to calm down, to relax, to help this inner landscape feel safe. As I said to someone the other day, to have our fear feel safe from ourselves. To have the inner landscape of what's happening safe. It's okay. It's all okay. So it can relax. To have the inner landscape, the inner mental formations, understand that they don't have to keep proving themselves. You don't have to keep defending yourself. You don't have to keep apologizing for yourself. You don't have to keep being somebody. You don't have to improve on conversations you had in the past. You don't have to plan the entire future of the human race, or your race. It's okay just to be. And as some of you know, one of the very important turning words that I received from my Zen teacher is when in a kind of, as far as I could tell, kind of a casual moment, he turned to me and said, just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough. That kind of just saturated me, filled me, kind of really struck me. Just to be alive is enough. Can allow the mental activities that we have to finally relax. Many of us are tired. Deep, deep weariness, deep kind of, even though physically, normally you might be, have got all the sleep you need, but if you go through the layers, you discover this deep exhaustion from this constant activity, doing and proving and making and getting, and that's part of the landscape of this inner mental formation, sometimes is exhaustion. So allow it to rest. Let it become calm. And so the end of that chant is the calming of these mental activities, the calming of the mental formations is happiness. And it's kind of like within us, deep inside, if we finally can kind of slow down enough, calm enough, we'll discover that we're beautiful. There's beauty in each of us. That everything, that anything that tells us that we're not beautiful, that we're not worthy, that we're not important, that we're not sacred or something, anything that tells us that we're not that, is just mental activity, just mental thoughts, desires and aversions. It's kind of surface from what's waiting for us inside, the happiness that waits, that is there, the beauty that you are. So here we are on retreat with ourselves as we are. It's okay. It's all okay. And as you get familiar with yourself more and more, perhaps you can make the space in the mind, space in the heart, so that the mental activities that you have can feel like it's okay to rest, okay to calm down, to slow down, to take their time. There's no hurry. Good message for your mind. There's no hurry. Slow down. And as you slow down, you might see this really amazing thing. Not only your beauty, but also the amazing thing that these thoughts and desires and intentions you have, they come into existence, they arise, they appear, and they disappear. They arise and they go. And this is an amazing thing to watch. And for the Buddha, this insight into the arising and passing of things is really the thing that makes us Buddhas, that makes us awake. So let's take a few moments to recollect back into our more practice mode.